Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up, Tony McVeigh has the latest on the legal case against Kentucky road contractor Leonard Lawson. First this morning, you may have taken a nice hot shower before turning on your radio. We don't want to spoil it for you, but did you know that water heating represents up to 17% of the energy used in your home? Well, there may be some new options for you now that the federal government has issued Energy Star standards for home water heaters. And manufacturing is just ramping up at the GE Appliance Park here in Louisville of a new so-called hybrid electric water heater that's designed to meet those requirements. This is no product endorsement. It just so happens that GE is the first to announce it's making these kinds of heaters in the U.S. If a wave of manufacturers follow suit, it could not only help consumers save on energy bills, but reduce overall energy demand. Kristen Espelon spoke with GE National Account Manager Greg Halliday about how the new technology works.
Instead of generating heat, we're actually moving some heat. We actually will cover and pull some of the warmth in the area right around the water heater and transfer it to the inside of the tank to bring that water temperature up. In doing that, we're operating a compressor that only draws about 700 to 800 watts versus 4,500 watts for a resistance heating element that's in a typical electric water heater. So the energy savings at that point becomes very significant. Now, the key to it being hybrid is the fact that it can switch between the heat pump technology and resistance heaters that are still present in the tank.
And resistance heat being generating the heat for the water.
That is correct. Okay. That would be 4,500-watt heating elements. And what we leave the heating elements in there so that we can still give the same one-hour recovery rate that a normal electric water heater would give. So let's say, for instance, you get up in the morning and one or two people take showers, and maybe they don't deplete but about 20 gallons of water out of the tank. Then the heat pump will continue to operate at that energy savings to replenish the hot water. But maybe that third person comes and takes a little bit longer shower, and now they've depleted half to three-fourths of the tank. The recovery time would be a little bit longer using just the heat pump. But so that it's a seamless transition for the consumer, we switch over for a short period of time to the resistance heating elements, bring that tank temperature back up quickly, and then keep it topped off with the heat pump from there on.
Would this particular technology work with a tankless model?
Well, with tankless water heating, you're really trying to provide water, hot water on demand, which means you have to have a superheating system that responds extremely fast, because as fast as you're pushing the water through, you're taking it from whatever the groundwater temperature is, which here in Kentucky would be somewhere around 55 to 60 degrees, and you're trying to run it up to 120 degrees almost instantly. To do that with gas, you can accomplish that. To do it with electric, you actually are using about five times the amount of electricity while that heater is on to create that. And with the electric technology and tank water heaters, the power companies generally don't look as favorably on those because it creates a huge draw. If a whole neighborhood had that type of a water heater in the morning when they get up and take showers, it would dim the lights. We really want this product to be utility friendly because their focus is on energy reduction, being able to save and to meet the needs of the community without having to build new power plants or do drastic things to alter the way we use electricity by billing us at a higher rate maybe in the afternoon and a lower rate in the evening.
Are any of the utilities financial partners in this project?
Not directly. What they're partnering in is being able to order the product first. And we've already had commitments from PPL, which is Pennsylvania Power and Light, some federal programs for low-income housing such as NeighborWorks, and right here in Louisville even from New Directions Housing Corporation.
So utilities will be able to order these heaters for consumers who order them, and then they'll be the primary installers?
For the first pass, we're making them available to the utilities, and each of these utilities has marketing plans in place where they will be offering them direct to their customers. And that way, they can seed these into the market, measure the amount of power that they're actually saving in generation, and get credit for that, because most of these utilities are under some type of an energy program that the state or the federal government has put them under, where they have to actually show energy reduction in their area.
And presumably, the utility companies would be able to perhaps mark up heaters and you know, cover their costs or, you know, make a little bit of a profit?
That is correct, okay. But some of them are so interested in being able to put it in the market that they're going to sell it directly through and even rebate it heavily. to where you're going to see an average of $300 to $500 on a rebate from the utility. The state of Kentucky was already very insightful to match in the percentage what the federal tax credit already does. Federally, a consumer putting one of these heat pump water heaters in would get a 30% tax credit on the installed cost of the product up to $1,500. The state of Kentucky, as of January 1st of this year, has a 30% state tax credit up to $250 for heat pump water heaters.
What are you aware of that researchers are working on now in terms of next generation water heaters? Will we see solar water heaters coming from GE anytime soon?
Right now, we are anticipating being able to bring that into the market next year with a solar thermal water heater. Solar thermal is a little different than what some people are, think of solar. You think of photovoltaic, which generates electricity. It's a nice form of solar, but it's very expensive. Solar thermal is really more of the everyman's product because it's much less expensive. You actually are circulating a food-grade antifreeze through panels that would be on your roof, only one or two panels compared to, and photovoltaic would be maybe a half dozen or more. So this takes up much less room, and we simply circulate this food-grade antifreeze through the panels, heat it up, and then transfer the heat from that to the water heater itself.
There are new developments, including a trial delay in the federal highway bid rigging case against Kentucky road contractor Leonard Lawson and two others. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has details.
Last September, a federal grand jury in Lexington indicted former Kentucky Transportation Secretary Bill Nybert, highway contractor Leonard Lawson, and Lawson aide Brian Billings on charges of conspiracy, misapplication of property, and obstruction of justice. The charges followed a year-long FBI probe into the awarding of $130 million of state highway construction contracts. All three men pleaded not guilty and have been awaiting trial. A successful change of venue motion moved the trial to Covington, but Federal District Judge Danny Reeves split the case into two trials. The first, set for June 23rd, would deal with bribery conspiracy charges against Lawson and Nybert. The second would cover obstruction of justice conspiracy charges against all three. But prosecutors balked and combined the conspiracy charges and re-indicted the men. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ken Taylor told the Louisville Courier-Journal, quote, "This calls what we see as a single unified conspiracy. But the move drew fire from Nybert attorney Howard Mann.
It appears clear that the re-indictment was designed to circumvent prior court rulings that were detrimental to the government's case, and that's more fully outlined in our recent filing.
Kent Wicker, attorney for Brian Billings, says he too was surprised by the government's pursuit of a superseding indictment against his client.
It has told the court time and again that he is not part of that conspiracy, that there are two conspiracies, and Brian Billings is not a party to that first conspiracy. So we were very surprised to see that the government is taking a position 180 degrees to the contrary now.
At their arraignment in federal district court in Frankfort, all three men entered not guilty pleas to the new indictment. It was also at the hearing that Judge Reeves revealed a possible conflict of interest that may require him to recuse himself from the case. More than 20 years ago, Reeves worked with a Louisville attorney who represented one of Leonard Lawson's companies. Reeves apologized for the lateness of the revelation, but said it just came to light because of evidence that may be presented at trial. Howard Mann appreciates the judge's candor.
He did some research this weekend before the parties were even aware or had it on their radar screen. The judge has indicated that the parties will have an opportunity to brief that issue and give any input they have concerning whether or not recusal is mandatory.
Mann hopes it's not. So does Kent Wicker.
We are hopeful that the law will allow him to stay on the case. He's put a lot of time and careful attention into ruling on some complicated motions. That's a judicial investment that we would hope will not be lost.
If Reeves does have to step aside, it could cause further delays in the case, which is now in its eighth month. To those who don't earn their livings in the judicial system, the delays hurt, says attorney Guthrie True, who represents Leonard Lawson.
Any delay is devastating to a client, and it is to this client, because he's the one that has to live with what goes on here. The rest of us live in this world. Leonard Lawson and his wife and his family do not live in this world. This is foreign to them, and they're anxious to move forward. And so to them, it's devastating.
For now, the case is on hold. The June 23rd trial date has been set aside. The next hearing in the case is later this month in Lexington. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Last week, Time magazine posed the question, can the arts survive the recession, but gave no conclusive answer. This week, WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer covered new cuts to state arts agencies that state legislators are considering this month in special sessions. Like arts agencies and states nationwide, the Kentucky Arts Council and the Indiana Arts Commission already have endured budget cuts. Now Governor Steve Beshear is proposing the Kentucky Arts Council take another approximate 3% cut, and Indiana's Mitch Daniels has offered the legislature a budget that halves funding to the Indiana Arts Commission. To get perspective on how states are handling public arts funding, Kramer spoke with Jay Dick of the advocacy group Americans for the Arts, which works with state groups Arts Kentucky and the Indiana Coalition for the Arts.
State governments are facing revenue shortfalls now, and that's forcing them to cut budgets. How are the state arts agencies faring?
It really ranges across the board. You have anywhere from a little bit of a budget increase in North Dakota. They do a two-year budget, and they added about $300,000 onto their budget, to Florida, where they've seen about a 70% cut in funding for that. And Florida is very sad because 3 years ago they had a budget of $34 million, and now it's down to $1 million for their cultural grant programs. And so, huge, devastating effect for the states. And then you have other states that are in the 50% cut range. These have not been totally enacted yet. You have Nevada and New Hampshire that are looking at 50% cuts. You have Michigan that is looking at maybe an 88% cut and an elimination of some grant programs. And then you have other states, like Kentucky, for example, that they're getting a little bit of a cut, 3, 5, 10% even, but all the rest of the state government is receiving the same cut. So they're being treated as equals to transportation, education, et cetera. And that's what we're asking. Because the arts do create jobs, do create tax revenues, that we should be treated as equals like everyone else. So if everyone else is going to get a 3% cut, we'll take it too. But don't treat us as unequals like in Florida or Michigan, where you're cutting us disproportionately.
I know that some states have certain revenues that are just used for the arts, and I didn't know if during this time have any states discussed trying to find new ways to support their arts agencies in the face of these revenue shortfalls or even looking forward.
Any good executive director is always looking for new ways to fund and support the arts. I think what you're referring to is a lot of hotel or bed taxes, where a percentage of the money goes to fund arts and cultural events. There's also some different areas out there that have special little tax on food going out to a restaurant that do help support the arts, culture, and tourism. So people are looking to some of those. The most interesting example I have is of new and unique ways to support the arts, and this is a first, is last November in Minnesota, the supporters of the arts were able to place on the ballot a measure to add 0.375 of sales tax to support the arts and culture. And then they had a couple interesting partners. And then also to support the environment and also to support the hunters and fishers. For 10 years, those three groups separately had been trying to put this constitutional amendment on the ballot and had failed. Well, they came together about 2 years ago and were successful. The ballot initiative passed with 63%, and Obama received 61%, so they did better than the presidential election. And now that's going to take the Arts Council's budget from about $10 million a year to about $30, $35 million a year. And what is really great about that, it's in the Constitution, and the state legislature can't do anything to take that money away. So that is a first there of writing a dedicated funding source for the arts into a state's constitution.
Are other states trying to do that, and what kind of challenges are they facing, or would they face?
Well, I know that Minnesota's next-door neighbor, Wisconsin, the environmental groups have contacted my arts groups to enter into a dialogue. It's a very long and an expensive process because you run a full campaign like you would to elect a governor. You're running a full-blown campaign. You know, just look at all the propositions that happened in California and how much money is spent on stuff like that. So there's a high hurdle to reach there, but the benefits are certainly there if you can actually do it. So, and only about 28 states, I believe, allow citizen initiatives like this. So there's a lot of states that don't even allow ballot measures.
Another thing that's going on is there's been the federal stimulus money has come through the NEA for the states. And how is this money being implemented and used in arts funding?
We are very happy at Americans for the Arts to work with a lot of our state partners, Arts Kentucky and the Indiana Coalition for the Arts, to put in $50 million for the National Endowment for the Arts into the stimulus package. And we hope for a lot more, but $50 million is still $50 million. And that money has already been going out to the different states. And I know in South Carolina that the state legislature took $500,000 of that stimulus package and turned it into grant-making for the South Carolina Arts Commission. That was a direct result of that $50 million there. So from the national level through the NEA, they're doing direct grants. But, you know, 40% of that money automatically went through to the states. I think that's about $21 million that went directly to the states. And so states like Kentucky and Indiana received around the $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 mark, I believe. So a lot of good opportunities. It all comes down to educating your legislature and your governor about how the arts do create economic impacts, how they do create jobs, how they do help the economy.
Given that we're in a recession right now, what are governments and arts administrators learning through this difficult period?
They're learning that they have to tighten their belts, and they're also learning that they have to stay in business because they do provide a really needed service to the community, like after-school educational programs or working with disadvantaged youth or whatever the case happens to be, or just making sure that every kid has the opportunity to see a play or a symphony or something along those lines. So they're learning that they have to stay in business. They're shaking every tree, looking under every rock for funding. They're trying to find more unique ways to get businesses or foundations to support programs that they're doing. Unfortunately, they have to cut costs. So a lot of them are laying off employees, or sometimes half-time employees now become volunteers. Even though they already ran a very tight ship financially, they're having to really tighten their belts the more. And the problem is when the government funding goes down, the foundation world and the private givers are not in the position, because their own ability to fund is down with the stock market and everything, that there's nowhere to make up that money. So when the government cuts out a lot of funding, and so maybe at the end of the day, some arts group is going to lose out on $5,000 of a grant that they might have gotten from one of their arts councils, that's a big deal. And that might be the difference between helping them keep their lights on and keeping in business or going out.
Given the experience in the recession that hit in 2002 and the one that hit in the early 90s, what have governments and art agencies learned through dealing with those? And how are those lessons, if at all, being applied now?
The biggest thing is our message has changed. What we've done has not changed. Our arts groups are out there providing a lot of great services to the community, but our message has changed. No longer are we going to the government, the key decision makers, and saying, you have to fund us because it's the right thing to do. It's good for everyone's soul. It is good, but what the key decision makers want to know is, what is this going to mean to our bottom line? What is this going to mean to our budget? So if you can go to them and say that there's 5.7 million people in the country that get their employment from the nonprofit arts field, or it's a $166.2 billion a year industry that puts in $30 billion in taxes into the economy, that's where now you have their attention. So it's a change of our message. We're really being acutely aware that every budget dollar that's appropriated in the state legislatures, the legislators themselves want to make sure that that money is being well spent. And when we can go and say, hey, the investment on the arts is about a 7-to-1 return on investment, that's when they say, oh, okay, and that's where we will either just hold our own or maybe even get a little bit of an increase, because it is a great investment.
Well, thank you for being with us.
I thank you a lot, Elizabeth.
There's more on arts funding at our blog, The Edit, at WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about migraines. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with Kentucky author Jim Tomlinson about his new collection of short stories. First, migraine headaches are a common ailment. The malady is sometimes damaging and frequently ignored. One migraine sufferer who didn't ignore his condition is Andrew Levy. Levy is a writer and the Edna Cooper Chair of English at Butler University. His new book, A Brain Wider Than the Sky, chronicles his attempts to understand, treat, and ultimately live with migraines. He talked with Gay Bullard about the book.
So your new book is A Brain Wider Than the Sky, A Migraine Diary. And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. The book itself is kind of a hybrid. It's a cultural history of migraines from 5,000 years ago to the present day. It's a description of the latest medical developments. It talks about famous people who had migraines and when they had them and how they mattered in their lives. And it's also a personal story. It's part memoir about myself and my own migraines and the headaches themselves, but also their effect on things like work, family, friendship.
And when did you start developing serious migraines or consistent migraines?
Migraines, for most people, they change throughout your lifetime if you have the chronic condition. For me, I started with at the age of 6 or 7, where I just got auras, which are these kind of neurological disruptions, usually vision, but not always vision. In my case, they were sort of shimmering stars. But at the age of 6 or 7, they were just fun to see. Then in my early 20s, my aura shifted and became a kind of a half-blindness, and then I started to get headaches that followed the auras, but only about once a month for about 20 years. Then when I was 43, which was just 3 years ago, I got one that just came and stayed for 4 months, and that's when I decided to write the book.
And there's a lot that I learned about migraines that just I hadn't really thought about before from the book, and one of them is the prevalence of migraines, more prevalent than depression, osteoarthritis, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis.
That's right. Approximately 35 million Americans have some sort of migraine condition. And the amazing thing, actually, is only about half of them know it. Many of them think they have sinus headaches or stress headaches, or many of them are just having the neurological disruptions, the auras, for instance, and they think they're just, you know, a little fuzzy from time to time. And of those 35 million Americans, only 12% of them actually take a migraine medicine. It's a sort of an extraordinary disconnection. People do not know how prevalent it is, even the people who have them.
And what's the danger of having an ignored or a misdiagnosed migraine condition?
Well, first is the pain, the senseless pain you're undergoing, as well as the confusion, since much of migraine's really a collection of symptoms, not just the headaches. And so, you know, people will often have extremely fuzzy periods where they can't say what they want or they misspell words and they don't know why. But there's a lot of people who are just trying to tough it out with headaches, or take Advil or acetaminophen, which don't help, when they could be taking something that's more directly suitable for migraine. It's a lot of wasted work days, a lot of canceled vacations, a lot of irritated couples, a lot of compromised families for no reason. It's also important to note that doctors recently are beginning to change the profile of migraine, that up until recently they believed that the headache just comes and it goes, but now they think that there are some longer-term risks to your health, that they increase your chance of stroke, especially if you're a woman, that they increase your chance of Alzheimer's, for instance.
So it can be a very serious medical condition.
It's certainly part of serious medical conditions, and you shouldn't just let them go, because there's doctors in the Netherlands, for instance, who have found extra brain lesions on the brains of migrainers as opposed to non-migrainers, and that's the kind of thing that you want to take seriously.
So what were some of the more surprising things you learned through researching and writing the book about the history of migraines and the treatment and the research into them?
Well, I was certainly surprised to discover how commonly accepted they were in medicine, 500 years before the birth of Christ. The ancient Egyptians knew what a migraine was, and that it has persisted for that long as one of the most sort of essential illnesses known to mankind. I was shocked to discover how few people recognize their own migraines. I was also surprised, and kind of on the counter side, almost in a pleasant way, how many famous poets, politicians, generals, musicians had migraines and found a way to work their creativity sort of into the migraine condition, almost using it as one of the gateways to that creativity.
And what did you learn about yourself in making this partly a memoir? What did you pick up there?
Well, I think that, you know, in the end, you know, I think that the best way you can treat a migraine is to really know your own body really well and to trust the signals. You know, that's especially true in this case because migraines, if you get to them early, let's say that you have a migraine that starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon like clockwork, get to it at 10 or 11 a.m. when you sense the premonitions, you're much more likely to avoid that migraine. You really have to listen to your body. If you feel a little extra yawning or a tear coming out of your eye or a little feeling of like your nose is melting like it's wax, you got to pay attention to this stuff. So I've learned to trust my body. I've learned to understand that I have a lot less control over these things, and in some way, accepting that is incredibly bracing and inspiring. I think I've learned to get a little bit more in touch with mortality, because migraine is a condition that makes you want to become catatonic. It shuts down your mind. It really is kind of a preview of what death is like, and it's not that much fun. So it makes you want to enjoy life while you have it.
And how are your migraines now?
They're pretty good. Thanks for asking. I get them about 20 or 30 times a year, but everything I just said, I'm better catching the premonitions and the triggers. And I've got some medicine, which is a migraine-specific medicine, which works pretty well if I catch it early. I can't stop these migraines sometimes. If the weather's really bad, if the sunlight, you know, catches you in the wrong way early in the morning, because early morning sunlight can be a trigger. You know, sometimes you can't stop a migraine, but most of the time you can, and I've gotten much better at it.
Do you plan on doing anything else in the field of medicine or any more research or writing in that?
You know, I'm supposed to be sort of an American cultural historian. I was writing a book about Mark Twain when the headaches hit in 2006, and I'm going to try to get back to it, but now it looks like my current project is to write about Thomas Jefferson, who is not only a fascinating American figure, but is also a migrainer.
Oh, any other historical figures you could throw out there as migrainers?
Sigmund Freud, he got a lot of the key ideas for psychoanalysis came out of migraines. They came out of the elation afterwards. Virginia Woolf, Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland is like an encyclopedia of migraines. Charles Darwin absolutely had migraines, and they filtered into his work as well. Ulysses S. Grant, Jefferson, as I said, and Georgia O'Keeffe, when she started to paint like Georgia O'Keeffe, told people that she saw those paintings in a headache. And those are like your definites. You've got maybes like Van Gogh, Picasso, Karl Marx. It's really a very extensive list of these sort of paradigm-shifting intellectuals.
You're certainly in good company then.
Which is oddly comforting.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I would like to stress to your listeners that you know, if they have headaches, they should treat them like a real disease. Most people don't. There's a 300-year legacy of people thinking that you're a hypochondriac if you have headaches. But it is a real disease, and there are real treatments. But the only person who can tell a doctor that is you. There is no test. There is no scan. There is no, you know, there's nothing else but you saying, my head really hurts on a regular basis. And you go into the doctor. If your GP doesn't listen, go to a neurologist. If your neurologist doesn't listen, go to a headache specialist. But trust yourself.
Mr. Levy, thank you very much for the time, and I really enjoyed the book.
Well, thank you very much, Kit.
Writers seek inspiration in as many ways as there are people writing. Kentucky author Jim Tomlinson finds his muse in the actions and language of everyday people doing everyday things. Tomlinson just released his second short story collection, Nothing Like an Ocean, and took the time to talk with Robin Fisher about his characters, why sense of place matters, and what's next for him.
Your characters are regular, everyday people, and I sort of wondered how they come to you, what your inspiration is for them. Are you out shopping and you hear someone make a stray comment, or how?
Yes. they come from many places, and it just sort of try and keep my pores open to whatever is happening, whatever I'm reading or seeing or hearing, and just try and soak that up, and eventually it comes out as characters in a story. And it may be 3 weeks later, it could be 3 years later.
You know, it's interesting, just now you mentioned that they may come from something that you are reading, and I recently reviewed an interview that you gave to the Lexington Herald Leader, and they mentioned when you were preparing to become a writer, you took some classes, and you mentioned reading. And tell us a little bit about how important you think reading is for the writer.
It's where you develop your ear for narrative and also your sense of what a story amounts to. Different writers are going to have different authors that appeal to them. And for me, there were a certain group of authors that really spoke to me and resonated with me. So I spent a lot of time reading in depth their work to try and build my own voice, not by copying theirs, but by sort of learning from what they were doing. And, you know, it's different for every writer as to who influences them, but it seems like an essential part of what you need to go through when you're learning to write.
And do you also do reading for background information?
I do. In fact, right now I'm working on a novel. It's a historical novel, and I'm doing a tremendous amount of reading of old journals and histories of certain regions and things like that. So that's also important. Plus, you know, if I'm going to write something about a meth addict, I have to read somewhere about what all is involved there. Or if I want to write something about a pastor in a church, I'll need to do a little research on that, either reading or talking to people that I know, just to get a sense of, you know, making it real.
Well, it is interesting. That is one thing that struck me about the stories in Nothing Like an Ocean, is that the characters were all, while they were all just pretty regular people, they were unique unto themselves, and there was no way that you could have had the personal experience of each of your characters.
Right.
And they were so believable that I just found that very interesting.
Well, I usually start out trying to write about somebody different from me, to start trying to understand other people. And, you know, it may be a school teacher or a copper thief or, you know, any number of possible people. But in the writing process, you start to put bits of yourself into this character who is different than you. And as you do that, the character gets to be more human and in some ways closer to you. So, no, I'm none of the things in there, but there is some level of the humanity that I've given them, I think, that helps a reader relate to them and have some affinity for them, even some of the more vile people that I write about.
Most of your stories in this book end with what I call an expectation of action, and you leave it for the reader to finish. And to me, that shows a tremendous amount of faith in your readers. And I wondered, do you think of the readers when you end a story, or do you feel that it has just come to its natural end and then it is up to the reader to take it from there?
I stumble a lot around when I'm writing a story, and I'll write a first draft and a second draft and then throw away stuff and add some stuff, and I'll go through a lot of revisions. And at some point, either in the second, third, fourth draft or whatever, I'll step back and say, what is this story trying to say? What's it trying to be about? And once I get that sense, then I can go and try and put it into being a finished piece. And what a finished piece amounts to for me is taking it to a point where the reader has a sense that, yes, this is the way the world works. This makes total sense to me. I understand it's fiction. It didn't happen, but it could have happened. There's nothing unreal about it. There's nothing made up about it, if you will. At that point, I think the reader is free to put their own interpretations and understanding of the events on the story. I don't want to lead them to some grand conclusion. That's not my idea. My idea is to create something that is representative of what the world is, and then let them fill in, okay, what does that say about how I perceive this? So the reader is a very active participant in the stories I try to write.
Well, you know, sort of along those same lines, it was interesting to me to read a review of the story, A Male Influence in the House, that completely differed from my interpretation of the story. And because I saw, without giving anything away to future readers, I saw especially the act toward the end as empowering for the boy.
Mm-hmm.
That he had finally sort of taken control of how he was going to handle his life in this particular situation. The review that I read focused more on the mother.
Yes.
Are you surprised sometimes when you read a review of your book or a certain story and you're like, wow, I didn't know I meant that?
Yes, sometimes. But I sort of invite it because most of my stories aren't told from a single point of view. I'm not writing about a particular character specifically. I'm looking at the relationship between two characters. And so to show that, I'm often switching between points of view. And in the story you talk about, A Male Influence in the House, I'm in Robert's point of view part of the time, and I'm in his mother's point of view part of the time. And people can attach themselves more to one character than the other and see the story quite differently depending. I mean, it's the same events happening, but viewed from the different perspectives, it can be seen as two different things, which I think is very interesting in fiction.
When I finished the book, and then I always sit a book down, especially when I'm getting ready to do an interview, take a few days, think about it, and then come back to it, I was surprised to find the theme of war that runs through the collection, from World War II to Vietnam to Iraq. Was that intentional?
What ends up in the stories is pretty much what's on my mind, I guess. So most of these stories were written in the past 3 years. There are a few of them that were written in the 6 or 8 years ago. But yes, that's in the air. That's what's going on, and so that does end up in there. It wasn't a conscious decision to have a thread through there, but it's the news that was daily at that time.
My favorite story is singing the second part. I find it interesting that the point of view of the main character changes as to her personal situation. The whole issue of poverty and how and what happens when someone is told they are poor.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the research that you did for that story. Did you find some personal stories of people who, during that time, and this was during Johnson's war on poverty time, who didn't realize they were poor until Johnson told them they were?
I moved to Kentucky in 1995,
mm-hmm.
and in about 2001, I started going to the Heinemann Settlement School, to the Appalachian Writers Workshop, and one of the classes that they have there in the afternoon is Jack Higgs does his talk on Appalachian literature and the Appalachian mindset and the myth and lore of Appalachia, and it was a great learning experience for me, not being from the area originally, as to what the influence, outside influence, on people and their perceptions of themselves in the mountains of East Tennessee and Eastern Kentucky.
It's interesting you say not being a native. I believe you're from Illinois, is that right?
Northern Illinois. Originally, I lived in New England for about 25 years, and I've been a Kentuckian by choice for about the last 14 years.
Well, I think you are a Kentuckian in your soul with the way you write about Appalachia. It really feels like it is your home.
It is, and it's home in terms of It's where I feel most comfortable in the world. It's where I choose to be, and so I guess that's the definition of home, not necessarily where you come from, but where you ought to be.
With the stories in this book, Nothing Like an Ocean, will they continue to stand on their own, or will one eventually evolve into a longer piece?
I had thought at one time that some of them might evolve into longer pieces. That was also true of my first book, Things Kept, Things Left Behind. There was a portion of that, which was about 70 pages or so of a novel start at one point, that just didn't quite seem to coalesce and work. It's possible some of this will come back in a longer form. I hope so. That's not the current project, but I think there's potential there for that.
Can you tell us a little bit about your current project?
I'm a little reluctant to talk too much about it other than that it's historical fiction. It's set in this general region during the Civil War period, and it involves the Shaker communities also. But beyond that, it's still too fragile to really discuss.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Thank you very much for your time.
You bet. Thank you, Robin.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Kentucky author Jim Tomlinson about his latest short story collection, Nothing Like an Ocean. Tomlinson will be signing copies of his book Saturday afternoon at 2 at Barnes & Noble at the Summit. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. At last week's Louisville Forum, a number of people presented their views on where a new VA hospital should be located in Louisville. The government is conducting a feasibility study on possible locations and the costs associated with them. Here's a portion of the forum.
Our next speaker will be Dr. Larry Cook. Dr. Cook is the executive officer for the University of Louisville's Health Sciences Center.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today and to recollect that in 1968 I was actually a medical student at the Louisville VA and continue to regularly attend meetings there. As our moderator indicated, I'm responsible for the research, educational, and clinical missions of the U of L Health Sciences Center, and it's an honor to serve as Executive Vice President for Health Affairs. It's a pleasure to be a member of this panel discussing this most important issue. And no matter how this and other discussions go, we must not lose sight of how wonderful it is that after decades of no new VA hospitals being built in this country, Louisville will have a state-of-the-art VA health complex new, and hopefully this complex will include a new hospital, new ambulatory facility or facilities, a new administrative center, and perhaps even a new research building. For more than 50 years, the University of Louisville School of Medicine has had the pleasure and the privilege of providing health care to Kentucky and Indiana veterans, as well as training our students and residents and conducting research. Let me assure you that no matter where these new facilities are constructed, that relationship with the University of Louisville is very precious to us and will continue uninterrupted with our most enthusiastic support and commitment. U of L tries to do all that it can for our veterans. We recently opened a veterans center on our Belknap campus to assist our veterans as they work their way through the higher education experience. We are about to launch, at the request of the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs, a very exciting new program whereby we will place one of our robots, our remote video robots, at the three state VA nursing homes, and through the robot make available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, our medical subspecialists with particular emphasis on geriatrics, psychiatry, and neurology. And finally, on the issue of healthcare, As was said, this is a 50-year relationship between the University of Louisville School of Medicine and the VA. And we have currently 54 of our faculty physicians in all specialties under contract with the VA. The VA supports 102 residency training positions, and on an average day, we will have 20 of our medical students located at the Zorn Avenue site. As a veteran myself, these efforts are all very important to me.
Our next speaker will be Ted Austin. Ted Austin is the State Commander of the American Legion, Department of Kentucky.
Good afternoon. When I talked to Ed about coming down here, he said, be brief. And so I assured him I'd be brief no matter how long it takes. You know, this thing's been talked about for the last, you know, like I say, doctor, in the last 5 years. First, let me assure that we are proud of the way U of L has handled the veterans issue here in Kentucky. I think we probably got one of the best VA systems in the United States, and we're proud of it. One thing that we do worry about is accessibility. We have a lot of folks that come to the University of Louisville, or the VA Med Center, from out of town. A lot of these folks are older folks. Now, one of the things that we've been hearing about lately is, well, you know, these old folks are going to die, and then we'll have a new breed coming in. Well, that's true, and that's a valid point, but you got to remember, these young folks are going to get older, too, and if they're lucky, you know. And I think as being an older folk, I'm kind of I guess I'm the poster child for getting older. We are deeply concerned with the traffic snarl up here in Louisville. I was in Congressman Yarmouth's office for an afternoon meeting here about a month ago, and he has a meeting with the veterans group similar to what y'all have asked us to talk about here today. And it took me 45 minutes to get from the Mazzoli building to hit I-65 coming out of here. You know, everybody that works downtown knows the traffic snarls normally that we run into in the mornings, around noontime, and the afternoons. And while I agree with the good doctor here that the close proximity does have a lot of advantages, it also has some disadvantages. And I noticed you did not mention University of Kentucky when we were bringing this. One of the biggest mistakes the VA has made in a long time is the way it was set up at the University of Kentucky. There's problems with missed appointments, no parking, because those parking ramps get full sometimes, and you know, you can put somebody on the door, but when it gets full, it's full. When an accident happens on I-64, I-71, or I-65 out of here, it is gridlocked trying to get in and out of Louisville. And the reason I bring that up is because there's been two or three new hospitals being built, and they're not being built downtown Louisville. They're being built outside the thing here. The physical location, you know, I went to the first meeting on this thing too as well. And we probably spent half the time telling us why a new hospital could not be built at Zorn. And, you know, I'm not an engineer, but when you can move a whole mountain over in East Kentucky, or you can cut a road right through the middle of the mountains, you can't tell me that you can't fill a sinkhole. I don't know what engineering group ran that one, but that's just what doesn't work.
That was last week's Louisville Forum. There is more information at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.